Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to another Monday episode of Inside the Octagon, hosted by me, Mr. Kalani Lua. Hope all of you had a fabulous, tremendous, safe, and fun-filled weekend. And hey, the Monday blues may have struck us, but I'm here to hopefully bring some cheer to your Monday as it's coming to a close and we get ready for the rest of the week. Again, this is Inside the Octagon, brought to you by The Sports Crib. The Sports Crib, you can catch every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A tremendous show as well. Also, you can follow me, Kalani, on Twitter at KLUA11. That's KLUA11. And also follow my sports page on Facebook. That is All Things Sports on Facebook. Folks, it's Monday. It's August 8th, which means we are less than 2 weeks away from possibly the most anticipated rematch in UFC history. I'm talking about UFC 202, headlined by one UFC featherweight champion, the notorious Conor McGregor, taking on Stockton bad boy Nate Diaz. And I got to tell you, we just had UFC 200 not that long ago, July, and that was supposed to be the main event. That was supposed to be the biggest event of the year. And by all accounts, before all the drama that ensued with it, it was. Before the changing of matches, McGregor Diaz not being on it, Jones then being pulled from it, Lesnar being added to it, if everything would have just lined up originally as planned, it would have been the biggest pay-per-view event of the year. But be that as it may, in a combat sport environment, as it says at the bottom of all the promos, card subject to change, and that it did. Now, UFC 202 is certainly lining up to overtake, dethrone UFC 200 as the pay-per-view of the year. Now, granted, there is a pay-per-view coming up in November, UFC 205, which will be the UFC's debut in New York City and at Madison Square Garden, the most famous arena in the world. Maybe that one, depending on how that card lines up, maybe that'll be the biggest and most anticipated card. But as of now, UFC 202 stands atall. And as I said, McGregor Diaz, part two, the rematch. Is this the most anticipated rematch in UFC history, folks? I got to tell you, if it is not, I certainly would love to hear what is. What's the biggest rematch in UFC history? Was it possibly Ken Shamrock, Royce Gracie 2? Ken Shamrock, Dan Severn, too? Maybe. Was it Chuck Liddell and Randy Couture, too? That's certainly up there, given that Couture pulled off the major upset moving down to light heavyweight and then dethroning what seemed like an unbeatable Chuck Liddell at the time. Their rematch certainly was up there. What about GSP versus BJ Penn, part two? At that point in time, that was the most anticipated UFC rematch of all time. You have two of the greatest fighters of all time, two champions, two guys who were in the prime of their careers. The first fight went the distance. It was a close decision that went to GSP. This certainly was there. And BJ certainly brought it with his promos, his trash talking about GSP. And then obviously when you got George St. Pierre, the physique, the look, the training, the warrior mentality, the ninja-like senses, it certainly led to be a big one. Frank Mir, Brock Lesnar 2, and UFC 100, that certainly was built up. The biggest pay-per-view event in UFC history at the time. You certainly had all the drama that went into it. Brock Lesnar being a former WWE star, first UFC fight lost to Frank Mir, even though he dominated, but 8 seconds of a mishap, he tapped out to a knee bar to Frank Mir. Frank with all the trash talking and saying, "I'm in his head." Unification of the heavyweight championship, which, let's be honest, whether it's MMA or boxing, there is no bigger prize than the heavyweight championship title. and that has been proven without a doubt throughout history of the two combat sports. So if you are the heavyweight champion, you are considered the baddest man on the planet. So that was up there. But now, McGregor Diaz, I've got to tell you, the feeling of this being the biggest rematch in UFC history, I got to say, it's number one. It is number one. And for a multitude of reasons, Conor McGregor, who in a way had a storybook-like ride. Here's a young man that before he got into MMA was a plumber's apprentice. For those of you who are Star Wars fans, you know, here's my apprentice, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Here's my apprentice, Anakin Skywalker. These are my apprentices, Darth Maul, et cetera, et cetera. He was going to be a plumber. Can you believe that? A plumber. Wasn't making ends meet and said, you know what? I want to try this fighting thing out. I'm still young enough. Let me go ahead and give it a try. Has a boxing background. Has a little bit of karate background in him, gets into it, does pretty damn well. And he does it in Ireland, which, thanks to him and a few other local fighters, guys like Joe Duffy, who have come up, it's really made Irish MMA more popular. It's spread out more. But before that, there wasn't as much to build off of like we have in other countries. You know, you look at a place like Japan or Brazil, or you look at a place like Great Britain, with all the boxing lineage they have from there, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Cuba, you know, that's boxing, but still, they had somebody in combat sports that they could relate to. Ireland didn't have as much. And then here he is, he says one day he's going to make it to the UFC, he's going to be the biggest draw, he's going to get paid millions of dollars, and he's going to be a champion. And when he came into the promotion, he had a lot of hype behind him. Could talk the good game. The fan base was just rallying behind him. And for the most part, in the ring, he was really backing it up. He only suffered two losses in his MMA career, which was earlier before he came to the UFC. So it was really like, can this kid back up and talk? He sure did in the cage. And then afterwards, he did some of the best, if not the best, mic work we've ever seen. One of his best phrases when he first got into the promotion was, hey, we're not here just to take part. We're here to take over. And that is still used today, promos and highlights. In fact, it is so used today that in the college football national championship game, Alabama's head coach Nick Saban used that same line for his Crimson Tide team and said, hey, guys, in the words of UFC champion Conor McGregor, we're not here to take part. We're here to take over. And sure enough, Alabama goes out there and gets another one for Roll Damn Tag. So his rise just, it came from nowhere only because, you know, the fans in Ireland knew who he was. But when he was unleashed onto the American fans, it was like, whoa. You know, the Irish accent, oh, hey, that lady, we're not here to take part, we're here to take over. You know, that's a little catchy. You know, he had the swagger, you know, he had the confidence that we said, wow, man, this guy, and he's backing it up in the cage with knockouts and ferocious striking and very good counter and good movement. And the way that he breaks down fights and opponents and his style, it was almost in a sense of mesmerizing. We all drank the Kool-Aid. And then he moved up, talking more trash about future opponents, how guys wouldn't stand with him. They were afraid to go at it with him. Obviously, what really put him on the map was his attack of then champion, who was undefeated for 10 years, Jose Aldo. It was like, dude, no one's ever attacked Aldo like this. What the hell is Conor McGregor thinking? What is he doing? And then, obviously, we all know the rest. He beats Chad Mendes for the interim title, knocks out Aldo 13 seconds in the first round. Bam. He is a star. He's been on ESPN. He's been on SportsCenter, Fox Sports 1. He's been all over. That was his rise to say he drives the fancy cars. He wears the fancy suits. He wears the El Chapo-style T-shirts, the glasses, the watches, the shoes. You know, he talks big money, in a sense, not to the same level or degree, but in a sense, he's like the Floyd Mayweather of MMA. Granted, It is very it is not on the same level due to boxing's long lineage history and everything that goes into, hey, boxers, especially Mayweather, they're their promoters. And boxing is not an organization. It is not a company like the UFC. It is, boxing is ran by the promoters. There's no president of boxing or there's no CEO cutting you off. You know, it's your promoter, or in Mayweather's case, you're the promoter. So what you can negotiate in a deal, that goes to you. Whereas in the UFC, that Dana White, that's the Fertitta brothers. Well, it was the Fertitta brothers. They sold the company. But that, you know, there is a chain of command before it gets to you as a fighter. But Mayweather has turned the game around. He's made it more exposed. He's brought it to mainstream. Hey, right here in Las Vegas, Nevada, when Conor McGregor has a fight, they literally call this place Ireland, Nevada. Because the Irish come here in swarming numbers. I've been to press conferences. I've been to weigh-ins. I've been to events where McGregor was here. I got to tell you, I felt like I became a leprechaun of some sort, and that's no disrespect to the Irish people. But I felt like, oh, my gosh, this place is just it's orange, green, and white all over the place. It is literally St. Patrick's Day every day here for that week. It's amazing. Great fans. They're very into supporting their own. It's a lot of fun. But that's McGregor's rise. Diaz was a little bit different. He had an older brother, Nick Diaz, who had been in the UFC, been in MMA, made a good name for himself. And instead of getting the immediate chance to just come straight to the organization, he had to go through the Ultimate Fighter Season 5, had to work his way through the house. Go ahead and get those fights out the way. You know, what is it, like 3-4 fights that you have to win in like 6 weeks to get to the finale or in total? He had to go that route. You know, being away from the family, being isolated from the world for 6 weeks in the house with a bunch of people you're not that familiar with or that you don't know at all. Being on TV on a weekly basis so people kind of get an inside look to who you are as a person, your personality, what you're like. And Diaz, you know, like his brother, does not hold his tongue, does not hold back his feelings about stuff, will certainly give you the middle finger at the drop of a dime, talks big trash in the ring, but backs it up completely. Has I don't want to say unorthodox, but he has a unique way of his boxing. You know, he's a southpaw, he's tall, he's long with the reach, but, you know, they like to throw out that Stockton slab where they just slap you upside the head. And on the side, and trust me, the Diaz brothers may not have one-punch knockout power consistently, but they certainly hit you with some mighty, mighty big stings. Tremendous jiu-jitsu practitioner, one of the best in MMA, Cesar Gracie, black belt. So, but one thing that's really different about Nate, the Diaz brothers, especially Nate, is that they're not as out there to the public as Conor McGregor is. They're not showboaters as far as trying to show you what type of fancy car they drive, fancy clothes, the jewelry. They're not about that. They're about making money and fighting. And Diaz, for the most part, Diaz taking on a who's who of Murderers Row in the UFC, taking on the top challengers, Benson Henderson, Donald Cowboy Cerrone, Gary Maynard, Josh Neer. Go on and on and on with the guys that he's been in wars with. Former champion Rafael Dos Anjos. And he always had a hardcore fan base, right? He always had the MMA fans. He never was able to get to the casual fan because, you know, he's not a big talker as far as being on the mic and being out there cutting promos and doing sightings as far as being on SportsCenter or ESPN or other TV shows. He never really got that push. Now, this is not a slap or a disrespect towards him or his brother, but let's be honest. When you hear them do interviews, they're not the smoothest talkers. They're not dumb whatsoever. The Diaz brothers are not dumb. They're not stupid. They're not slow. They're not they're none of that. But sometimes it is hard to get through a full interview with them because sometimes you get a little lost in what they're trying to say. Sometimes it's a little mumbling. Sometimes they kind of get off the rails a little bit with what they're saying. They kind of take you all the way around the park before bringing it back home. And you say, oh, I see, okay. And when you got guys like Conor McGregor, Chael Sonnen, and a few others, where they give you the rhymes and riddles and the quotes and the sayings, and they just make it entertaining for you to listen. Then when you listen to someone like Diaz, who kind of keeps it simple, straight to the point, it's almost like, all right, man, I get it, but where's the entertainment value? Well, the Diaz brothers tend to show it in the cage. They show it in the ring. They show it in their fights. And the fans, the hardcore fans, they've always noticed it. Diaz has been in the UFC for about, what, 8, 9, 10 years now? He fully understands and knows his worth, but understood that, you know, he never got the chance to really capitalize on his popularity with the fans. Now, granted, some of that is because of his promotion skills. They're not up there with the likes of McGregor or Chael Sonnen or even a Frank Mir when he fought Brock Lesnar. But then also, there were times where Diaz did stumble when he was one fight away from a title shot, his one time getting a title shot against Ben Henderson, and he just came up short. That also plays into it as well. One thing in combat sports, and really in any solo sporting event, tennis, golf, you have to win. You have to win. You want to get the big money. You want to be the main event. You want to be the guy, so to speak. You want to get the push from the promotion. You got to win. You got to win. And for Diaz, he's won a lot. He also lost quite a bit. So that also held him back tremendously as well. But his rise came from the fact that, you know what, the hardcore fans believed in him. He believed in his worth, and he said, I am going to get some wins, and if I do lose, hell, like his saying is, I'm gonna kill or be killed. And I'm going to go out there, and I'm not going to be an easy win for anybody. And he hasn't been. For the most part, Diaz has never been an easy win for anybody. So anyways, his rise comes, and he's like, okay, I was gone for about 15 months because of a contract dispute with the UFC. He was a co-main event at one point in time in 2014. He got paid $16,000 for that event. Sage Northcutt, a 19-year-old phenom, his first fight in the UFC, which was and he got the win, but he clocked in $80,000. Now, granted, I totally understand that Sage Northcutt, there was a lot of media clicks and hits on his name. There was a lot of buzz around him. Fans were very interested to see him. This young kid who literally looked like a mixture of Jean-Claude Van Damme, Ivan Drago, and Ken the Barbie doll all put together. I get that. The blonde hair, the big smile, the eight-pack abs, the muscles, the flips. Yeah, yeah. People were very interested in it. But he clocked in $80,000. Whereas you got someone like Diaz who put in 8 years of grinding in the UFC against the murderer's row of the who's who. I'm talking 16K as a co-main eventer? So you can see where as fighters in MMA, where jealousy, dislike, disagreement, disgruntlement, you see where it comes into play. But anyways, he goes out for 15 months on contract disputes with the UFC. He wants more pay. And as I said last week, Diaz showed his popularity in the sport when he came back last December. I had a show at a UFC Fight Night in Florida, in Orlando. And he took on a fighter, Michael Johnson, who lives and trains in Florida. He's not from there, but he lives and trains there with the Black Zillion. There were more fans cheering for Diaz, who's from Stockton, California, in Florida, than there was for the hometown kid. That just showed you, hey, he's a real star. There are fans who love the Diaz brothers. UFC took notice of that. Diaz also took advantage of his post-fight interview with calling out Conor McGregor. Fuck that, Conor McGregor. You're taking everything I work for, motherfucker. I want to fight your fucking ass. I'm the real money fight. And that set the seeds for their collision at UFC 196. Now, originally, it was supposed to be McGregor, Dos Anjos for the lightweight championship. McGregor was looking to become only the third UFC fighter to hold a title in two different weight classes, the first one to hold two titles simultaneously in two different weight classes and the promotion. So that was supposed to happen. RDA gets injured, falls out of it. Diaz steps in on 11 days' notice, and, well, we all know what happened. With Diaz winning that fight, the way that he did with the submission, his star is now higher than ever. And now he is looking to get these big payday fights. He's even said, win, lose, or draw on this one with McGregor, he wants big fights afterwards. He wants the money. He can't blame these guys. I mean, when you make $16K in a fight that you train 8-10 weeks for, you're out there putting your body and your life on the line. You sacrifice time with your family. You're sacrificing your body with weight cutting, dieting, and training, and taking a beating every day. It's tough. And when you live in a place like California, it's not cheap to live out there. So, you know, you can see why these fighters want to make more money. And that's what Diaz wants to do. And now he gets a chance for his second biggest payday in his rematch against McGregor. But both of these guys' stars has risen. McGregor brings Ireland with him. He brings the casual fans with him. He brings the spectacle, the lights, the attraction. Ooh, what's that event going on over there? Diaz, in a sense, he brings the hardcore fans. He brings the guys that are true to the sport, guys who are all about the warrior mentality, guys who are all about that grind. In a sense, it's like Conor McGregor is England. And it's funny because he's Irish, but it's like he's England, and Nate Diaz is Stockholm. He's Scottish. Scotland, yeah, excuse me. But he's Scotland, kind of like in Braveheart, you know, where you had the big, fancy army with the uniform and the shields and the spears and the flag. And then you take a look across the field, and you see a whole bunch of ragtag put together farmers with pitchsticks and axes and half swords and no uniform put together and just, whatever you got on, you're going to go at it. That's Nate Diaz. And he brings that same fire and passion from his fans into every fight. And McGregor brings all the attraction. He brings the casuals out to see him. Stars want to see this guy in action. And he's very well worth it. But when they get in there, these are two warriors who put on tremendous shows in all their fights. And this second one, it is leading to biggest showdown, the biggest rematch in UFC history, and possibly pay-per-view buys, ticket gate numbers, the biggest event this year, even over UFC 200. So this being the biggest rematch in UFC history, yeah, that's pretty damn accurate. Nate Diaz claims and says he was the bigger draw before McGregor came along. That he was the guy. And in a sense, you know, he's got somewhat of a claim to that. I don't know if it's totally legit. The UFC has tried to say that he wasn't a needle mover. He wasn't someone that the fans craved for as far as outraged to want to see him fight consistently. And as I just said, you know, the hardcore fans were like that, but not the casual fans. But Diaz, in a way, you know, when he called out McGregor and said, you're taking everything I work for, in a way, what McGregor did and has done in his UFC career for his rise, in a sense, is some of the things that a fighter like Nate Diaz did. Took no shit from nobody, talked shit about the division, his opponent, claimed that he was willing to face anyone, anytime, any place. It did not matter. Put him in front of him, line him up, and I'll take him down. When the stare downs come, they're some of the most intense stare down that you've seen. Come to fight, they go out there and they swing for, not necessarily swing for the fences, but they're going out there to win. They're not going out there. They're the same. You play, or in this case, fight to win, not fight to lose. And that's what Diaz and McGregor both do. Neither one of them are point fighters. They do not have to go out there and just hold positions for the sake of winning the round. They don't go out there looking to just beat you by points. They look to go out there and win, to beat you. But as I said, Diaz did have times where he stumbled, lost a fight or two here and there where it was like, okay, Nate, you know, we want to give you this push, buddy, but you just lost. You failed at this attempt. You moved up here and it didn't work out for you. Whereas McGregor, up until his loss against Diaz, was undefeated, was backing up everything. So it's much easier to get behind and push somebody who's winning as opposed to someone that's, you're 50-50. You're inconsistent. So Diaz does have some claim to that overall as far as saying, hey, you know what? I was the biggest star. Yeah, among the hardcore fans, sure. But McGregor did what someone like Ronda Rousey, with Brock Lesnar, with John Jones, with George St. Pierre did, what Chuck Liddell did. They didn't just tap into the hardcore fan base. They tapped into the casual fan base. They tapped into people who weren't MMA fans or who didn't watch it consistently. They tapped into saying those fans want to watch those guys fight every time. They wanted movie stars, TV stars. Hey, can we have them for an episode of our show? Can they make a cameo in our movie? We're doing a commercial. Can we borrow this fighter? That's what Conor McGregor was able to do, something that Nate Diaz wasn't able to do. Hence why McGregor was getting the big payday while he was getting all the advertisement. He was must-see TV. Must-see TV. And that's just the way that it is with sports in general. Okay? There's a reason why Peyton Manning and Tom Brady get the commercials, especially Peyton Manning. Granted, he probably doesn't turn down any commercials, but there's a reason he gets the commercials. There's a reason Eli Manning gets the commercials. One, they're good at what they do as far as being in commercials, making them funny and appealing. But they back it up by going out there and winning football games, putting up numbers, making it exciting, must-see TV. So that's what McGregor was able to do. And if Diaz can capitalize in his rematch and put up another tremendous fight, especially if he wins, he's going to become that guy that's must-see TV now. He's going to get the riches and the fame that he wanted. Well, how will he embrace it and how he will respond to it remains to be seen. He has shown throughout his career, for the most part, he's not afraid of the spotlight. He's not afraid of the competition. He's not afraid of the challenge. But if the money's right, hey, I'm all for it. I'm all about that check, about that check, about that check. Now, in this rematch, one of the big questions is, will Conor change his style of attack for the rematch, or will he continue to headhunt as he did in the first one? One of the things that's very interesting about Conor McGregor, and we've seen this a couple of times, more specifically and more recent, we've really seen it with one Floyd Money Mayweather. And here's my comparison. When Mayweather first was coming into the sport of boxing, he was known as Pretty Boy Floyd, the son of Floyd Mayweather Sr., the nephew of Roger Mayweather, Olympic bronze medalist, fast hands, quick, high boxing IQ, great defense. And Mayweather came under a lot of criticism his last 10 to 12 years of boxing for his style. But if you look at when he fought as Pretty Boy Floyd, if you look at Floyd Mayweather before 2006, Mayweather was known for knocking people out. Mayweather was known for finishing guys, as did Corrales, who got knocked down 5 times in their fight. And Chico is one of the toughest boxers in those divisions, you know, the 135, 140-pound division. And he was undefeated when he fought Mayweather. Mayweather put him down 5 times and made it look easy. Made it look easy. Angel Manfredi, very talented fighter, very tough, rugged, very good power. He got done up easily by Mayweather. Mayweather was aggressive. He was coming forward, fast hands, looking to get you with hooks and uppercuts, straight, giving you the business. As Arturo Gatti, Arturo Thunder Gatti, you know, the warrior, the guy that just would go out there and he was all heart, speed, good counterpuncher, good movement. But at the end of the day, Gotti was always known for just throwing the game plan out the window and just fighting you. Obviously, his biggest war was his trilogy battle with Irish Mickey Ward. The first one gave us one of the greatest rounds of all time, the ninth round. And that really propelled Gotti back into the spotlight of being one of the top boxers, one of the fan favorites. Well, when he took on Pretty Boy Floyd Mayweather, Mayweather showed him. Arturo may have the thunder, but I got the lightning. And man, oh man, did he embarrass Gotti. Speed, accuracy, combinations, defense, movement, but a high offensive output. I mean, he literally put on an onslaught on Gotti that made you feel sorry for him. Made you literally feel sorry for Gotti. And in the sixth round, he finished him off with the corner just throwing in the towel and saying, that's it. It's over. Now, this was back when he was Pretty Boy Floyd. Now, when he got the moniker Money Mayweather, you know, when he took on Oscar De La Hoya in 2006, It changed. Because now he was in the big fights. He was in the big pay-per-view numbers. And he wanted to win because that's how he was marketing himself. I'm undefeated. No one could beat me. And he changed up his fighting style, became more defensive-minded, more of a counter-striker. Sure, Mayweather always had the problems with his small, brittle hands, but that never stopped him from being aggressive early in his career. But as he got into the bigger fights, he became more defensive-minded. And that, in a sense, made a lot of fans, not fans of his, criticize him. Well, if you circle that around to Conor McGregor, if you look at his first few fights, if you look at his first fights in the UFC, Conor at times was a bit of a tactical, mathematic, scientific fighter. But what I mean is he used a lot of movement, a lot of, not necessarily, but in a way, a Capoeira style. Those of you who have played Tekken, you remember the Capoeira fighter on there. You've seen, obviously, some mixed martial arts or some kung fu movies where guys, you know, would do the Capoeira with the movement back and forth. But he used a lot of movement. He used angles. Combinations, and he had the power, but he wasn't a one-punch, big swing, let's go for the home run, knockout punch guy. He would set you up with combinations, counterattacks, very accurate with his striking output, and then once he caught you, it was over. But as he got up into the UFC, UFC 189 last year, knocks out Chad Mendez with the left hand at the end of the second. UFC 194 knocks out Jose Aldo with the left hand, 13 seconds into it. You know, now there's really nobody in the 145-pound division outside of Max Holloway who has shown that they can withstand Conor McGregor striking. So when he moves up to fight Diaz at 170 pounds, he takes the mindset in of, I can knock this guy out because I've been knocking out guys. I knocked out Dennis Seaver, Chad Mendes, and Jose Aldo, and that was just in 2015. So now, instead of me being this strategical movement, pick my spots, you know, a very accurate striker, I'm going to go out here, I'm just going to look to land bombs. I'm going to throw nothing but overhand left, show him throwing some uppercuts, but overhand left, every punch I'm going to put my all into it, trying to drop this guy. I'm going to throw in a few spinning heel kicks, trying to catch him against the cage, I'm hoping to get that high leg wheel knockout. Now, granted, you get those. You get the knockout of the night, the performance of the night. You know, you get that bonus, tremendous highlight reel for your career going forward. The fans love it. Who doesn't love a knockout, right? But it was counterproductive in this particular fight against Nate Diaz. Diaz was a taller fighter. Diaz was a longer fighter. Diaz was a heavier fighter. He's naturally a 155-pounder, but he has fought 170-pounder. McGregor has never fought above 155 pounds in his career, let alone 145 pounds in the UFC. So he underestimated the fact that moving up, guys will be able to withstand his power more in the bigger division. And Nate Diaz, who's only been finishing Diaz strikes one time in his UFC career, has a very solid chin, was able to take those punches from McGregor. And with every punch, McGregor's energy was being zapped more and more and more. It's almost like being a game of Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat. Your energy level was just going, boom, 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 boom. And we saw in the second round how McGregor was just, his cardio was shot, tired, and gets caught with the left hand. And then, you know, bon voyage, adios, amigos, submission knockout. And McGregor, now you got to say, in this rematch, are you still going to try to be the headhunter? Or are you going to try to come out and go back to your roots of picking your spots, using your movement, striking from unorthodox angles, you know, being accurate with your punches, not trying to wind up with every big shot, letting the finish or the fight come to you instead of you coming to it? It's going to be very interesting to see what McGregor decides to do in that regard, in that aspect of the game. Because if he comes out looking to headhunt, which McGregor recently said he doesn't see Diaz getting out of the second round, he'll finish him in two. Okay, you know, you did land some good lefts in the first one, and now because you do have the time for a full camp to put on the proper body weight, when he fought Diaz, he weighed in at 166, 168 pounds, so he wasn't even at the 170 limit. So now you do have time to do to eat steaks, so go ahead and put on the weight, cut down maybe to 170, and you're right there. Okay, you have time to work on your power, go ahead and work on, you know, lifting weights and striking against guys who are taller and putting it in, okay, sure. You know, with the accuracy and the success rate you had in the striking in the first match, I can see your confidence into the second one saying, now that I'm preparing for this guy properly, I can finish him in two. Okay, this is Nate Diaz we're talking about. He don't get finished. He does not get finished. So, yeah, I think the best way for McGregor to be is he's got to be methodical in his approach towards Diaz. Diaz himself, who's an unorthodox fighter, you know, he's tall, he's long, he's got a wide stance, but he likes to throw out that right that right jab, the right short Stockton slap hook, followed with the straight left. He's got very good boxing, you know, like, you know, uses a shoulder roll, some head movement. But he's also, at times, a stationary target. So that if you're not trying to come in straight ahead like a bull in a china shop and just rush him, but you're picking your spots, you're countering, you're using the footwork, you can pick apart Diaz. One of the most interesting things, we did see this in the first one, McGregor did throw some leg kicks at Diaz in their first fight. He threw some oblique kicks and he threw some leg kicks. One of the weapons that Rafael Dos Anjos used to beat Nate Diaz in 2014 was leg kicks, because Diaz does have a very wide stance. He leans on that front leg very heavily for his boxing. Well, Dos Anjos said, okay, you want to lean on that leg? I'm just going to throw leg kicks at your partner. And we saw throughout the fight, which at that time was a three-round bout, we saw that Diaz was having trouble walking around. He didn't have as much pop and sting on his punches because he couldn't put as much weight and pressure on his front leg. And that certainly could be something that McGregor goes to in this matchup. Throw some leg kicks, throw them early, go to the body a little bit more, and break them down that way. You know, the saying in boxing is, hey, go to the take out the body, the head goes with it. We've seen it in all the Rocky films. Go to the body, Rock, go to the body. We've seen it in some other fights, the movie Gladiator with Cuba Gooding Jr. and Brian Dennehy. You know, at the end when Cuba had the head injury, but he still had a fight his opponent. Went out there and was hitting him in the body, and she was like, what, you sprayed hit me in the head? Hey, here to not take out the body. The head goes down with it. So if McGregor does decide to attack the legs and the body of Diaz, that could be where he finds his most success. And then when you go low, you always know. You throw a feint to the body, come over the top, the face and the head is going to be wide open. And McGregor's power and his accuracy in that left hand, maybe he does tag Diaz on the chin, and maybe he does wobble him and get him to shake. Very possible. But Nate Diaz, trust me, he is not someone that's easy to put away. And Nate Diaz is certainly one that he himself, now with a full camp to train and prepare for Conor McGregor and himself to be in shape, he says, I see how you wanted to come at me the first time. If that's how you want to attack me again, I already know how to defend that, brother. Trust me, I'm used to it. I train with professional boxers. I trained with Andre Ward. I trained with professional kickboxers and Muay Thai world champions like Joe Schilling. I trained with my brother, Nick Diaz. I trained with guys like Gilbert Melendez and Jake Shields. I'm ready for that. So if you want to stand up and strike, let's go, baby. Diaz, who, as I said, is a superior Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner, one of the best in MMA, considering how good he is on the ground, you would think that he would want to take guys down more. But in UFC career, he's only got 16 takedowns, and 5 of those came in one fight. So will Diaz look to take McGregor back down to the ground? That's where he would have the advantage at, but it is also highly unlikely because Diaz, who's very confident in him in his skills and in himself on wherever the fight goes, he's like, look, whether we stand up or go to the ground, I got the advantage, man, so it's whatever. You know what I'm saying? Where do you want to fight? You know, you want to go ahead and keep this fight standing, I'll box you up on the feet. You want to take it to the ground, I'll grapple you. So for McGregor, got to go to the legs, got to go to the body, and then also get the clinch in. Because Diaz is long, you don't want to allow him to use his reach. Get him in the clinch. Make him punish him in the clinch. You got to attack him inside. You got to make this a phone booth fight. You got to make it dirty. When you're in the clinch, you got to take advantage of that. So, yeah, how will Conor attack this fight? We know how Diaz is going to do it. Diaz is going to sit there looking to counter, looking to tag you with the 1-2. If you look to take him down, hey, he's got good takedown defense, but he's also superior on the ground. So it's really a matter of what's Conor going to do. Nate is going to have the same game plan for every fighter no matter what. I'm staying here in the middle of the cage. I'm going to circle. I'm going to stand here waiting for you to come at me, and I'm going to tag you. Now, once I tag you and I rock you, that's when I'm going to start coming forward. That's when I'm going to start throwing my hands up. That's when I'm going to give you the middle finger. That's when I'm going to say, what up, bitch? Come on, bitch. And that's when I'm going to come at you, and that's when I'm going to be looking for the kill. So it's all about the game plan. What's the game plan of Conor McGregor? McGregor feels he can finish him in two. McGregor's coach, John Kavanaugh, thinks he can finish him in four. So it is going to be interesting to see what will Conor McGregor do as a game plan for this one. Be the aggressor like he was in their first fight and see if he has better luck in the outcome this time or get back to his roots that got him to be in the successful, that got him to the top of the UFC featherweight division, that got him to be the biggest draw in the UFC today, and be methodical, be strategic, be unorthodox, find his distance, find his range, you know, find his angles, find his move, get his movement going. We shall see. We will see. Being that this is the biggest rematch in UFC history, and being that Conor is still the 145-pound champion, being that Nate, you know, even though this isn't his natural division, he does have one win over McGregor, who's under more pressure to win here, you guys think? You think it's Conor McGregor or Nate Diaz? For Diaz, it's his chance to prove that the first win over McGregor wasn't a fluke. It's his chance to prove that it wasn't McGregor getting tired. It wasn't McGregor underestimating Diaz being able to withstand his punches. It wasn't a late replacement, and it wasn't a lucky left hand that led to the rear naked choke submission that got Diaz this. This is Diaz's chance to prove once and for all that he's the better fighter than McGregor, that he is a superior and elite athlete and fighter in the UFC, and that he does deserve to take on the best of the best in either the 170 or 155-pound division. So there's that pressure, but that does not amount nor lead up to the mountain of pressure that is on Conor McGregor. Again, just like Floyd Mayweather, and I go back to Mayweather only because he's the most recent fighter that people can relate to, but then also there's a lot of similarities between these two. The fact that McGregor built himself up as nobody could stand toe-to-toe with him, nobody could withstand his power or his striking that he has. He can take everyone's head off. He's the man. No one's going to beat him. Now, to McGregor's credit, since his loss, after fight and up until now, he has said all the right things about losing. He makes no excuses. He did not take anything away from Nate. He does not sit here and say, oh, well, I had an injury or it was this. No, he says, look, it was a bad game plan. I didn't execute correctly. I went out there, underestimated how good of a fighter he was. I've always respected him, but I really thought my power would be too much for anybody. And I just underestimated that moving up guys who are bigger can withstand more of a shot than guys who are at the 145-pound division. So that was on me. But credit to Nate for the victory. So he has said all the things. Hey, I'll be humble in victory or defeat, but I'm a fighter. This is the fight game. This is what happened. But he has also built up this mountain of invincibility, which was destroyed by Nate Diaz. He's got to get it back, right? And granted, if he loses, he can still go down to the 145-pound division. You can take on intern champion Jose Aldo. You can unify the championship. You know, he can fight guys of that nature. The 135-pound champion, Dominic Cruz, he has said that he can move up to 145 and possibly take on Conor McGregor. And you're in a super fight. So there is that. McGregor can also move down to 155, and he can also take on guys in that division. Like I said, originally earlier this year, he was supposed to fight for the lightweight championship against Rafael Dos Anjos before the injury, so there's still that. But McGregor needs to get some of that swagger back, some of that headline status back. He needs to get back to show that the first fight, which wasn't necessarily a fluke, but rather, hey, I got caught. In this game, anybody can get caught, but I'm back now, and I can rebound better than ever. The last time he lost a fight before he entered the UFC, he went on a tremendous winning streak in the UFC to show that, hey, I bounced back tremendously from losses. Can he start his bounce back successfully from his first loss in the UFC at UFC 202? That remains to be seen. And certainly, it's going to be something everyone is going to be interested in. Look, we have a whole lot more to talk about with UFC 202, but we got another week's show for that. So next week, UFC 202, that is all it's going to be about, is UFC 202, breaking down the fight, predictions, analysts, game plans, all that necessary stuff. But I wanted to get to a couple of things here before we wrap up the show here. Again, this is Inside the Octagon, hosted by me, Kalani Lua, brought to you by the Sports Grid Podcast, which you can listen to every Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. So one of the things I wanted to mention was right now we are halfway through the 2016 calendar. It's August, so we're a little bit more than halfway through, but you get what I'm saying. Already this year, we have six brand-new UFC champions already. You know, the year is not done. We're already at that point where we have these new champions. We have a new 135-pound division champion, Dominic Cruz, a new 155-pound, which is the lightweight champion, Eddie Alvarez, a new welterweight, 170-pound champion, and Tyrone Woodley, a new middleweight, 185-pound champion, and Michael Bisping, a new heavyweight champion, and Stipe Miocic, and a new women's bantamweight, 135-pound champion, and Amanda Nunes. Now, we have seen fighters such as Dominic Cruz, who won the title earlier this year in January and defended later on this year as well successfully. We've seen that. We have seen Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson defend his title successfully this year. He was supposed to defend it at UFC 201, but an injury pushed him back, so we'll see him later on in the year. We have seen Joanna Jędrzejczyk defend her title successfully this year. And we've seen Daniel Cormier. Well, no, it wasn't even a title fight against Anderson Silva because, you know, it was a leg replacement, but we've seen him in action this year and be successful. But six brand-new champions already. Six. And it makes me want to ask this question. Is this a trend that will continue throughout the year, or will we start seeing champions successfully make their defenses? Like, what is better? Is it better for the changing of the guard in the division to happen more often, constantly new champions, one or two title fights into it, or is it better if we have a dominant champion? For the division overall, it's better if it changes hands. Obviously, more fighters get a chance to be the champion. They get a chance for those big paydays. They get a chance to get their name out there. And it shows that the division itself is actually pretty talented. Remember when Ronda Rousey was just dominating the 135-pound women's division? And we all thought, well, that division is just, it's crappy. There's no one in it. Ronda pretty much is going to run through it twice over, retire undefeated, and move on to Hollywood. Holly Holm comes around, head kick KO, shocks the world. Her first title defense, Misha Tate comes in, rear naked choke in the last round, shocks the world. Amanda Nunes comes in for her first title champ, shot. She knocks out, she knocks down, breaks the nose up, and then taps out Misha Tate at UFC 200 in the first round, shocks the world again. And now we're looking at the division, we're saying, man, there's a lot more talent here than we thought. Juliana Pena, Castagano, we're seeing that, you know, Holly Holm is still there, Misha Tate is still there, now Nunes is up there. You know, we're seeing that, man, there is some talent here. Valerie Shevchenko, who just beat Holly Holm, hey, she's up there now. Now you're looking at that 135 division and you're saying, you know what, it's not so one-sided with Ronda Rousey at the top. There's a lot of challenges here. In the men's lightweight division, the 155-pound division, that has always been one of, if not the toughest division in the UFC historically, dating back to when James Pulver was a champion in the early 2000s. That's just a fact. That is, there was always talent at that division vying for that championship, which made it more impressive that BJ Penn was a champion as long as he was in that division. So, you know, you're looking at this and you're saying, man, it's crazy how it is how these championship bouts change hands so often. You look at the UFC Heavyweight Championship, Stipe Miocic makes his first title defense at UFC 203 in September in Cleveland, Ohio, after he knocked out Fabrício Werdum in Brazil earlier this year at UFC 198. In the UFC Heavyweight Division, the most title defenses for the title is in two. Two. Dos. Or if you speak Samoan, Lua. Get it? So, there's only been two title defenses in that. Very, very hard to hold on to a championship in the UFC, which makes guys like Chuck Liddell, Matthews, George St. Pierre, BJ Penn, John Jones, Anderson Silva, Demetrius Johnson. It makes their title reign that much more impressive, that much more appreciated, and it shows you just how good and dominant they are as fighters, but as champions. Because it is hard. It is hard to defend that championship because, you know, you get relaxed. You get like the days ago, and you don't really, you know, evolve as a fighter. You think what's worked for you so far. Hey, it got me the championship belt. I continue to do the same thing, but you got to do more because the fighters underneath you trying to get that championship, they're hungry just like you once were. Like the famed middleweight and boxing Hall of Famer, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, said, it's hard to get up every day and get motivated to fight when you're waking up in silk sheets. You guys remember Rocky III when he took on Clubber Lang? Remember how Rocky was initially? Well, I had 10 titles of fights. And, you know, I'm doing this for charity, and I'm a showman. I'm doing all these commercial and advertisement. And then you saw in the other monologue, you saw Clubber Lang running the alleys by himself, training by himself, doing pull-ups on a wooden 4x4. You know, he's hungry, fierce, angry because he's being looked over. It's what happens sometimes when you're a champion. And in a way, I think that's what's made the UFC sport overtake boxing. Is the fact that when it comes to UFC, you never know what's going to happen. You never know. Did you know that Holly Holm was going to knock out Ronda Rousey and dominate her the way that she did? No. When Verdum won the heavyweight championship from Cain Velasquez, many thought he was going to hold on to it for quite a bit. First title defense, Miocic knocks him out in less than, 2 minutes in the first round. Dos Anjos looked like, hey, with his grappling, his striking, his jiu-jitsu, as strong as he is and as aggressive he is, he might hold on to the title for quite a while. One title defense. Boop! Eddie Alvarez takes him out. Robbie Lawler looked like he was going to be the next great welterweight champion following those of George St. Pierre, that of Matt Hughes, and said, hey, you know what? Okay, this is that of Pat Miletich. Hey, this is the next great welterweight champion. He had the war with Johnny Hendricks, the war with Robbie Lawler, the war with Carlos Condit. Yeah, someone really knocked him out in the first round. It is very, very hard to defend these titles in the UFC. Holly Holm beat Ronda Rousey. Hey, she's going to be the next queen of the division. First title defense down. Misha Tate, she's finally put it together. She's going to be the next queen. First title defense down. Amanda Nunes remains to be seen. Juana Jacek, she certainly looks like she's the queen. She is the queen of that division. She looks like she might be up there along with Dominic Cruz to be a long-range champion. But she's got a ways to go to catch Dominic. I mean, excuse me, not Dominic Cruz, Demetrius Johnson. Excuse me, Demetrius Johnson. But in the sport of boxing, when's the last great upset you can really think of? And then, how many upsets do you really have in boxing? For the most part, most fights, if you're just looking at it as a boxing fan and not as a fan or hater of one of the fighters, you pretty much know who's going to win. You know, when Pacquiao took on Mayweather, sure, many of you wanted Pacquiao to win, but deep down, you knew Mayweather was going to win. When Gennady Golovkin fights, you know he's going to win. Canelo Alvarez fight Miguel Cotto. Yeah, sure, there was a possibility Cotto could win, but we all knew Canelo was going to win. You know, there's not a lot of upset in the sport of boxing, which is fine. You get long-range champions. You get guys who are showing their dominance and how good they are. But then, in a way, it kind of takes away some of the excitement, some of the unknown that goes into fights. If you kind of already know, this guy's going to win. Yeah, I know the other guy's good, but I've never heard of him or I barely know him. So, this champion's going to win. You know that. But in MMA, you never know. You don't. Every fight is unknown. Every fight, one punch, one submission, one grappling technique, it can be the difference. And a long-range champion being dethroned, or a brand-new champion looking to make his first defense, or their first defense, because we have women, so I don't want to say he, but making their first defense, a short one. You just never know. And that's the sport of it. And that brings some excitement to it. The unknown. So you know, when it comes to the difference in MMA and boxing, that's one of the major ones. Boxing, I don't want to say it's predictable, but if an upset happens in boxing, it's rare. Remember when Hasim Rahman upset Lennox Lewis for the heavyweight championship that no one saw coming? Yeah, remember that? Next fight, Lewis put a clinical beat down on with the knockout. But how long was it until we had another upset? What, Antonio Tarver knocking out Roy Jones Jr. in their second fight years later? Okay, the big gap in between. Mayweather facing Oscar De La Hoya. Sure, in some circles you could say it was a slight upset. But let's be honest, for the most part, we knew that Mayweather would win. You don't get consistent upsets in the sport of boxing like you do in mixed martial arts. And I think that's one of the reasons the UFC is the fastest growing sport in the world. I think that's why in some circles it has overtaken boxing, not in just one aspect, but just as a whole, because boxing has shown when the big fights are happening, when the stars are facing other stars, fans will come out and support it. The pay-per-view numbers will be there. The ticket sales at the gate will be there. The buzz and the talking of it will be there. But it's not consistent. It's not as often. So the gap between those moments are few and far between. Whereas in the UFC, it's one after another, after another, after another, after another. Look, yeah, UFC, yeah, UFC 199. I mean, 198. You had a heavyweight championship bout. 199, a middleweight championship bout where two new champions were crowned. UFC 200 was supposed to have a title fight, but didn't. 201, championship bout where a new guy was crowned. 202, two of the biggest names in the sport going at it. 203, heavyweight championship on the line. So, you know, the UFC gives you, on a monthly basis, championship bouts after championship bouts where you never know what's going to happen. So that's interesting in its aspect, and I want to know. And you guys hit me up on Twitter at KLua11. That's KLua11, KLUA11, or hit me up on All Things Sports on Facebook. That's All Things Sports. Let me know. Do you like the constant changing of the guard at the high level in the champion with the championship belt, or do you prefer a long-standing champion? Do you prefer someone who goes on a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 title defense streak? Which one do you prefer? That'll be interesting to find out. Also, real quick, before we wrap it up here with only a few minutes left to go in the show, one of the baddest women, if not the baddest women in the world right now, Chris Cyborg Santos, set to make her second UFC appearance next month in Brazil on a UFC Fight Night card, and she headlines against possibly Lena Landsberg. Cyborg, who made her successful debut earlier this year at 198 in Brazil, successful against Leslie Smith. And I just want to ask this before we wrap it up. I understand that Cyborg fights at 145 and her fights in the UFC, this will be her second one, are at 140. It's very hard for her to make 135, but when are the other top names in the UFC going to step up and take on Cyborg at 140? When are those big fights going to come? These ladies who are starting to get more and more headline fights, more and more bigger fights, they also want to get those big paydays, right? Well, what's a bigger payday than taking on Cyborg Santos? Sure, Ronda Rousey's out there, but when's she going to come back? When are we going to see Holly Holm, Misha Tate, step up and take on the baddest woman there? When are we going to see Kat Zingano do it? Most importantly, when are we going to see Ronda Rousey do it? That's the big question, and we can get into that more in the fall, in the coming weeks. But, guys, thanks again for tuning in to Inside the Octagon, brought to you by me, Kalani Lua. Check me out every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This show is brought to you by the Sports Career Podcast, which you can listen to every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. And, yo, again, follow me on Twitter, KLua11, Facebook, All Things Sports. Until next week, guys, have a good, tremendous week. Be fun, be safe. Make some good, positive vibes happen this week. Until next week, guys, have a good one. Take care. Peace. California.
eardrum like a slug to your chest. Like a vest for your Jimmy in the city of sex. We in that sunshine state where the bomb ass pimp be. The state where you never find a dance floor empty and pimp be. On a mission for them greens.